are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. I got a call. I got a girl hung herself in the guest house. The call came on the morning of July 13, 2011 from the historic Spreckles Mansion, a lavish beachfront property in Coronado, California, owned by pharmaceutical tycoon and multimillionaire Jonah Shacknai. When authorities arrived, they found the naked body of Jonah's girlfriend, Rebecca Zahau, gagged, her ankles tied and her wrists bound behind her. Jonah's brother, Adam, claimed to have found Rebecca hanging by a rope from the second-floor balcony. On a bedroom door in black paint were the cryptic words, "She saved him. Can you save her?" Was this scrawled message a suicide note or a killer's taunt? Rebecca's death came 2 days after Jonah's 6-year-old son, Max, took a devastating fall while in Rebecca's care. Authorities deemed Rebecca's death a suicide resulting from her guilt. But who would stage either a suicide or a murder in such a bizarre, elaborate way? Award-winning investigative journalist Caitlin Rother weaves stunning new details into a personal yet objective examination of the sensational case. She explores its many layers, including the civil suit in which a jury found Adam Shacknai responsible for Rebecca's death, and the San Diego County Sheriff's Department bombshell decision to reconfirm its original findings. Compelling as it is troubling, this controversial real-life mystery is a classic American tragedy that evokes the same haunting fascination as the JonBenet Ramsey and O.J. Simpson cases. The book that we're featuring this evening is Death on Ocean Boulevard, Inside the Coronado Mansion Case, with my special guest, journalist and author, Caitlin Rother. Thank you so much for this interview and welcome back to the program, Caitlin Rother.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Thank you so much, and it's great to have you discussing this incredible new book, Death on Ocean Boulevard. Let's start off, right as you do in the book, to getting to the crime scene where this Adam Shacknai calls 911 to report a suicide. Someone hung herself in the guest house. Take us to this Ocean Boulevard in this July and tell us what happened July 13, 2011. What was that 911 call?
Okay. Before I get started, I just want a crime, quote-unquote, book. But there actually is no criminal case. So when we call it a crime scene, it's actually a death scene. And I just have to be really careful because nobody has been accused of a crime, in this case, in criminal court. So Adam Shacknai basically was at the guest house of his brother's mansion. It's known as the Spreckles Mansion. It's a historic house here in San Diego County on what we call an island. It's basically a piece of land that is connected to the mainland only by a strip of land, and there's a bridge across it, and there's two active military bases there. It's largely a retirement community, and there's a lot of very expensive homes there. And people like Jonah Shacknai, who live in hot places in the summer, like, you know, the Scottsdale, Phoenix area, where he generally was living the rest of the year, they buy homes over here, and they, you know, come over here during the summer when it's just too hot to be Arizona, Texas, places like that. Mm-hmm. So Adam Shacknai, though, is a tugboat captain. And he flew in from Memphis when his nephew Max had that terrible fall from inside the mansion. Now, that was less than 48 hours before he called 911. The night before he woke up and called 911, he had flown in around 4 o'clock, and he had dinner with Rebecca and Jonah, and there was really hardly any conversation because they were all very upset about Max, because Max was in the ICU, when Rebecca had found Max, he was not breathing and his heart had stopped. It took him 25 to 30 minutes to get him back. So he was in the hospital. Jonah was just having a quick meal, and then Rebecca drove him back to the hospital, drove her and Adam back to the mansion. And then they, you know, drove into the driveway, and Adam told me that he offered to talk to Rebecca about what had happened in case she felt like she wanted to talk, because he had flown out to be supportive to the family, and she was his brother's girlfriend, but she didn't want to talk. And according to him, you know, he doesn't drink, and Jonah doesn't drink, Rebecca didn't drink, didn't do drugs, they're all health nuts. But Adam told me that Rebecca said to him, "I don't drink, but if I did, tonight would be the night," essentially. I don't know if I'm quoting it exactly, but that was in essence what she said. So she went into the main house, according to him, and he went into the guest house. He called his girlfriend, who he'd been seeing for, you know, a good 20 years, and she, her name's Mary. And so they chatted for a little bit, and Adam said he took an Ambien and went to sleep. So when he came out the next morning, he woke up. He said he'd kind of slept a little fitfully, and he was anxious when he woke up, so he masturbated that morning to porn on his phone. Now, he admitted this, right, volunteered this to police, okay, which, you know, some people have wondered, why did he do that? Took a shower, came out, and was on his way to ask Rebecca if she wanted to go get some breakfast and coffee. But he came out and he saw what he thought was a mannequin or something hanging in the yard, because, you know, Jonah has two teenage kids, and he thought, well, maybe they did something as a gag. But as he looked closer, he saw that it was Rebecca hanging there, and she was naked. Naked, her hands bound behind her back, her feet tied together, and there was a gag in her mouth. So it was a T-shirt that was wrapped around her head several times on top of the hanging rope and on top of her hair. So women have said, well, that right away is strange, because if, you know, when you're a woman, you have long hair, you don't want a rope or something on top of your hair. You usually would pull your hair out. Well, so granted, if you're in the kind of shape that the authorities say she was, she was going to commit suicide, maybe she wasn't thinking about that, but that has raised some questions with a lot of women I've talked to. So anyway, he doesn't know whether she's dead or alive, so he says he runs into the kitchen, grabs a knife out of the drawer, and she's too high up, he says, for him to reach her, so he's got to bring a table over. So there's a wooden table, a three-legged table. It's three-legged because one of the legs is broken. So the leg falls off when he drags it over, and you can actually hear the leg bouncing on the bricks, you know, as he's dragging the table over. He says he gets up on the table and stands on the table and pulls her to against him. He cuts the rope above, takes her, you know, in his arms and lays her down on the grass. Now, this is while he's on the 911 call. So you hear all of this on the 911 call. You can hear him grunting and cussing and panting, and he doesn't know the address, so he can't send the paramedics to the house without running to the front of the house, finding out the address, and then telling him the number. And he says, it's where you came to get the kid, you know, yesterday. Well, it wasn't yesterday. It was 2 days before, and they don't have the same dispatchers working every single day, so they had no idea what he was talking about. So this took quite a while as he's running around. You can hear all of this on the tape. So then he gets her on the grass, he says, and once you see the pictures, you can see there's this orange, reddish rope. It's like a ski rope, you know, like a water ski kind of rope. And
right.
It's got her such that, you know, she's in this really kind of contorted position. So her hands are behind her back, and her knees are bent. So the dispatcher says, well, you know, is she alive? And he goes, I don't know. So at one point he says, I don't know. Another point he says, I don't think so. But she has him, you know, tells him to start doing compressions. And he tells police later that he had already been doing compressions because she says, you can count out loud. And he starts out 27, 28, 29, as they've been talking. So, I mean, I didn't hear him doing any breathing. I only listened to the tape once or twice in court. But anyway, that was a little odd. But like I said, if you look at the pictures, it's not a good position to be doing compressions on somebody because you can't get a proper, can't get her lying down properly. So the police come and the paramedics, and the paramedic touches her jaw, and it's cool to the touch, and he can tell that rigor mortis has set in, and so he says, you know, never mind, they're not going to do CPR. So rigor mortis is a tricky thing. There's no, you know, nobody would give a firm, nobody at the medical examiner's office anyway, would give a firm estimated time of death. So, but generally speaking, it had to be at least a couple hours. So, you know, different estimates have put her, the last known contact that she had with anybody is on a phone record, and it's her boyfriend, Jonah, who calls her from the his room. He's staying at a place that's next door to the hospital for the parents get to stay if their kids are in ICU. And he calls her at 12:50 a.m., and Adam calls 911 at 6:48 a.m. So that's the general window of time, although she didn't answer the phone when Jonah called. So we don't know for sure, but that's the last time somebody tried to contact her. The last time anyone actually did talk to her was her sister, who's also named Mary, which made the book hard to write, going back and forth between the Adam's girlfriend and the Rebecca's sister. But they spoke around, I think, 10-ish. So that's the time frame.
Now, police talk to Adam soon after, and you talk about them not securing the guest house for about 3.5 hours. But you talk about Adam saying right away that he thought that Rebecca had killed herself, and that's what he indicated even in that 911 call.
Right.
So what is exactly, what do police determine from this scene, and in their mind, what would be the reason for Rebecca to commit suicide?
Well, okay, so the thing that's interesting about this is the Coronado police are the ones who initially responded, and that's the same agency that came 2 days earlier to respond to another 911 call from the same house when Rebecca found Max on the floor, you know, after apparently he, you know, we should probably go through that because this is related. Okay, so the reason they thought that was because there was this other incident that came 2 days earlier. So I'll run through that first. So Rebecca and Jonah and Max and Rebecca's little sister, she's only 13, and she had flown out for like a month-long visit. She, the rest of Rebecca's family in Missouri, she came out, and they were going to go to the zoo after Max, you know, cleaned his room and what have you, and she took a shower. So Jonah was at the gym, and Rebecca was downstairs. This is what she told police later. She said she was going to the bathroom, essentially in the bathroom downstairs. This is a mansion that's like 3 or 4 stories high, and there's the bedrooms where Max and her sister were staying in were 1 or 2 floors up. They're on different levels. And then there's a chandelier that's hanging from above. So, you know, it's quite a big foyer with a big opening and a big tall space there. And I've never been inside, so I've only been able to see pictures, so I can't describe it perfectly, but that's the best I can do. So anyway, Rebecca's in the bathroom, and she hears the dog barking. She's got a Weimaraner, I don't even know how to pronounce this, Weimaraner, 14 months, really big dog, very big enough to apparently knock an adult over, and Max is only, you know, 6. So very boisterous dog. and the dog is barking, and she hears a crash. So she comes out, and there's Max lying on the floor at the bottom of a staircase. And the staircase is one of those ones that kind of dog legs up all the way up to the second floor. And I think that's where the chandelier was hanging, was from the ceiling of the second floor. So that's all open in there. And there's this, you know, it's a you know, 1908 house designed by John D. Spreckles, the of the Sugar Fortune.
Mm-hmm.
So she comes out. She sees Max lying on the floor, surrounded by pieces of this chandelier, which has broken and fallen and is lying next to him. And there's a soccer ball and a razor scooter. The razor scooter's lying over one of his shins. So there's lots of different variants, thinking of COVID. A lot of different variables of what could have happened. But basically, she says, you know, when they ask her, and Jonah asks her, and everyone asks her what happened, she says, I don't know. I didn't see it. I just don't know. And so she thinks, you know, he probably fell from the second story landing up where the bedroom is. And so that's what she says. I don't know. He fell from the bedroom. And then they're like, well, did you see it? How do you know that? You know, so this is where things start getting messy, because Max's mother, Dina, she doesn't like Rebecca. She doesn't get along with Rebecca. She doesn't trust Rebecca. She's had lots of conflicts with Rebecca, which has caused a lot of problems and tension in the relationship between Rebecca and Jonah. And so after this happens, Dina is convinced that Rebecca somehow has something to do with this. And so she's complaining to people at the hospital, to the doctor. But I know that when the police came that first time, there were a number of the same officers who responded to the second 911 call. So, you know, they already had it in their head that she was there when this little boy fell or whatever happened, and they had to rush him to the hospital. So you have that in their minds. They were literally some of the same people and saw that she was upset. Okay, obviously, she was the only adult in the house. He was in her care, and this terrible thing happened to this little boy who she loved so much, like her own son. She was taking care of him. So when they show up the second time, they already have it in their head that she was the one who called 911, or actually her little sister was the one who called, but she was shouting out to the dispatcher the entire time. And she said she was giving the little boy CPR, but it's actually written mm-hmm. in one of the reports that none of the, I think it was a paramedics report that said nobody saw her doing CPR when they arrived. So that right. has been also an issue of some contention. So basically they have it in their head that she's upset, but there was also a psychologist who was doing a ride-along with one of the police on the day of Max's 911 call, and she later was asked to write up a report, and she said, I didn't, you know, she was upset. She was understandably upset this had happened, but she didn't seem depressed. She didn't seem suicidal. So to answer your question, you know, initially, Coronado called in the sheriff's department because they thought it was a suspicious death. And so they called out the homicide team. So the homicide team is the unit that responded. And so when Adam immediately said, I got a girl hung herself in the guest house, you know, I didn't hear them confronting him really about that. And I asked questions, you know, this is years later. I should also say that I was not allowed to come to the news conference that they had when they announced that it was a suicide, which was about mm-hmm. 7 weeks later, because I don't have a press pass anymore in San Diego because I am not a member of the working media. And even though I write these stories in far more depth than any of the actual working media, they just don't let me come to these. They didn't let me come to the two news conferences they've had during this case, which at the time I thought was pretty strange, because I had a previous case, the John Gardner case, where you've talked to me before, the book Lost Girls. They
right.
let me come to that one, but they didn't let me come to this one. So I was suspicious about that, too. You know, why wouldn't they let me come and ask questions? So I couldn't hear, you know, how they answered that. But years later, they basically just said, well, you know, we don't decide somebody's a suspect and then find evidence to fit that scenario. We see where the evidence takes us. Okay, well, seems like, though, when you listen to the interviews with the detectives that they did, I have the whole investigative file here that a source gave me early on, and not the sheriff's department, some other source. and I could hear, you know, just from how the detectives were talking to other suspects, that within a few days, they had pretty much decided that Adam was cleared. And so Jonah's whereabouts were pretty much, you know, they decided Jonah was where he said he was at the place next door,
right,
called the Ross McDonald House. And that Dina, who did not get along with Rebecca and was upset about what happened to Max, that she was at the hospital as well. And it says in the nursing notes that she and Jonah were talking to the doctor at 10:38 p.m. the night before, when there was a witness who saw someone who he thought was Dina at the house the night before. It turned out to be her sister, according to the sheriff's department, and according to the woman herself, her name is Nina Romano. So there was a lot of suspicion, and a lot of it, you know, about Rebecca being involved in Max's fall. And, you know, they were immediately suspicious that she had something more to do with it, and maybe that's why she committed suicide, because she felt guilty, not just because he fell, but because maybe she had something to do with it. Now, that's never been proven by anybody, but that's just, you know, the mom's and the sister's suspicions. So to answer your question, I don't know why they decided that Adam was cleared so soon. He took a lie detector test, and it was inconclusive, and the examiner decided, however, that he was telling the truth. Now, other outside experts have since looked at the same results and said, no, he was being deceptive. So, you know, there's a lot of outside experts who've looked at the evidence in this case and who've looked at, you know, the decisions made by the sheriff's department, and they just don't agree. But the sheriff's department decided that it was suicide.
What about the idea that Jonah, being this very, very wealthy person and influential person in this very, very quiet community, say he hadn't had a murder in 12 years, what about the idea that he had some kind of undue influence over the investigators' decisions regarding the suicide?
Right. Well, one other thing that I didn't mention, what they ultimately said was, when they came out with this ruling, which was 7 weeks later, was that there was no fingerprints or DNA evidence tying Adam to the scene.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so basically this rope that she was hanging from, tied around her neck, was actually over the top of this exterior iron railing along a small balcony on the second floor from the guest room. And that was the guest room where her sister had been staying, but she had sent her home the day before because she's like, well, you know, this is not going to be any fun for you. This is not going to be vacation. There's too much going on. Max is in the hospital. So she sent her home and picked up Adam at the airport in the same trip. So that guest room, though, is where her hanging rope was anchored to the leg of a bed, okay? And there was a note, a message of some kind that was painted in black paint on the bedroom door, and the one that you read at the beginning, she saved him, can you save her? Now, I don't know why they decided that was a suicide note. There's a lot of debate over that, what that means, and to this
mm-hmm.
day, they still don't want to say what they think it means because they don't know. But it's in the third person, and there's no punctuation, not even a question mark, and it's all capital letters. So, anyway, so the sheriff's department, and there was a note on her phone, two notes on her phone, that were sort of like, they thought more like journal entries, like when you're angry at somebody and you write a letter to them but you don't send it. There was one
sure.
of those, which she had apparently written to Jonah. She was upset about how he was taking his kid's side. So not only did she not get along with Dina, she also didn't get along with the mother of his two teenagers. So he was married already twice and divorced, so had three kids. Did not get along with the ex-wives and did not get along with the teenagers either, who she felt were very disrespectful to her. So there was a lot of conflict in the relationship. She was angry at Jonah. And Jonah later told me that there was so much conflict in the relationship that if that had not changed and it didn't look like it was going to, they were in the throes of breaking up at the end of the summer. They'd already talked about that. So the sheriff's department said, look, the relationship was in trouble. Things were bad. She looks really depressed. She's talked about, you know, feeling hopeless. She was crying all the time. She couldn't sleep. And these were in the notes on her phone. So that was in their mind when they decided it was suicide. Now, the other interesting thing you asked about Jonah, well, in the first day, they interviewed him twice, right away and then a couple days later, and he initially said he didn't think she committed suicide. Her family, the detectives talked to both of two of her older sisters, Noam and Mary, and they both said she wouldn't have done this, she wouldn't have committed suicide.
Right.
So there were a number of people that they talked to, including her ex-husband. They all said she wouldn't have committed suicide, and yet they still decided that she committed suicide. During these interviews, Jonah initially said he didn't think she committed suicide because it was just not something that she would do. She was so considerate that she wouldn't have done this when Max was in the hospital, when Jonah needed support. In his mind, he was saying, you know, she's my support system. She just wouldn't have done this. She would have more likely have driven off in a car someplace, you know, and done that, but not like this. So a lot of people were saying, no, no, no. But at the same time, he was also saying, can you please make a statement, because this is really hurting my business.
Right.
Can you make a statement that I'm not a suspect? And they kind of were like, well, we can't really, you know, I don't know if we can do that. We'll see what we can do. But so he was putting quite a bit of pressure on the sheriff's department to move this along and to, you know, announce that he was not a suspect, because he said, you know, it's really hurting his shareholders and blah, blah, blah. So, and that's literally on tape. So that's partly where those allegations have come from, but a lot of it comes from people just don't understand, people in the community, and the Zahau family in particular, don't understand how you could call this a suicide under these circumstances. And so they want to find a reason, and they think, well, it must be because Jonah's rich, and maybe, you know, there were, you know, there's allegations that have been made, you know, maybe, you know, I had this woman come up to me in Home Depot, a stranger, and she's like, you have to prove that somebody, you know, bribed the sheriff. And I'm just like, whoa, whoa, whoa. You know, that's a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
So, but that's what's out there. People just don't believe that a woman would have done that to herself, and not Rebecca in particular. And so that's been a pretty common allegation, and it has also come from the Zahaus and their attorney as well. So they say, well, at first we thought it was incompetence, but now we think it's so obvious that it was a murder. And this jury verdict even said that it was a murder. In civil court, it's called wrongful death. But, you know, that it must be corruption, it must be something else that's going on. So
Let me ask this question about Rebecca's state of mind. Was crucial to say that she contemplated and decided to commit suicide, and that was the
right.
Sheriff's Department's conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
But what about the phone call that Jonah made while getting reports from the doctor at the hospital?
Mm-hmm.
What about that last phone call to Rebecca the night before? What of that and its content?
So we have phone records that show that Jonah did, in fact, call Rebecca at 12:50 a.m. And he said, you know, they also found some footage, some video surveillance footage at the hospital itself, where you can see him leaving the hospital entrance and walking to this building next door. There was an issue, however, with the card reader going into the other building. Wasn't working, and there were certain cameras that weren't working with the route that he went. So there's nobody saw him going into his room, which some people have raised questions about, but the sheriff's department was satisfied by looking at the video footage and looking at him in the hallway, I think, of the other building, that they were satisfied that that's where he was. And his phone records show that he did make this call, and it was a voicemail. And they had Rebecca's phone, but unfortunately they could not get into Rebecca's phone. So I'm not sure if it was a newer phone, but they just did not have the technology to get into the phone. So they were never able to listen to that voicemail, partly because it had been deleted. Now, we don't know who deleted it. They assume Rebecca deleted it because there were no other voicemails on the phone, and so they, mm-hmm. being detectives, said, well, this must be a habit of hers to just delete voicemails, and that's why she listened to it and deleted it, because that was the habit that she had. We don't know that, though. So, mm-hmm. so we've never actually heard this voicemail, but we do know he did call and leave a voicemail, okay? They didn't really examine the phone because they assumed that it was Rebecca's phone and therefore her fingerprints were going to be on it. They didn't look to see if anybody else's fingerprints were on it, which I think they probably should have. So what Jonah said and what Jonah told the police was that he called her to let her know that he had talked to the doctor. This is Dr. Peterson. The doctor had said to Dina and to Jonah, and that's right around that same time where the nursing notes say that they were talking to the doctor. This was a different doctor. They had talked to this doctor first, and he was very blunt, apparently, and really upset Dina, according to Jonah. She went into kind of hysterics, which she denies, but that's a whole other issue. But anyway, the doctor and what the doctor said is unclear. The doctor can't even really remember, but basically, what Jonah said was, he said the best scenario was that Max would never walk or talk again. And so Dina didn't want to hear that. Dina didn't have any idea that the injuries were as bad as they were, and she was convinced he was going to recover. She just couldn't hear that. So I guess she got really upset. Jonah went and got another doctor, and that's the doctor who is recorded in the notes that they were talking to at 10:38. But apparently it was, you know, clearly bad news. Right. And so Jonah told me that he called Rebecca. I know I have the records as well, and it said it was a 62-second phone call that he left for her. And he said he was crying, basically just reporting the bad news. And not, he said he wasn't blaming her. He wasn't angry at her. He was just really upset about getting this news. So we have no proof of that. We don't know exactly what he said, but that is consistent with what he told the authorities. But he told me he was crying. He didn't tell them that. He told me that. Jonah doesn't want to be seen as a weak person and doesn't want people to know he's crying. And we kind of talked about that during the interviews. I spoke with him 8 times right towards the very end of putting the book together. I thought I was done writing it, and then I ended up getting a hold of him finally. I had to redo a huge portion of the book and rewrite it and add new sections right on deadline at the very end, but I felt it was very important to put in things like that because we hadn't heard anything from Jonah before, and there are a lot of allegations, like we just talked about him and having undue influence and the sheriff, you know, being, you know, somehow in collusion with the Shacknies because Jonah had all this money. So I wanted to give them a fair shot to respond to those allegations, which they vehemently denied. But Jonah basically said that the doctor was just, you know, really blunt. And so we don't know. We don't know, but that's what we do know.
Let's use this, Caitlin, as an opportunity to stop just for a second for our sponsor, which is FabFitFun. FabFitFun Spring Box is centered around the theme Grow Forth, supporting self-care and self-growth in the new season ahead. My wife Lisa and I are planning to grow forth into the spring season by reconnecting with family and friends and getting back into hobbies and activities that we plan to do outside. My wife Lisa was excited to get her FabFitFun Spring Box and wanted to get a head start this year on our garden, so she was anxious to get her LED indoor planter by Short Stories and get started planting seeds for our garden this summer. Lisa loves all the FabFitFun items relating to skincare, like Grown Alchemist Body Cream with mandarin and rosemary leaf, and Josie Moran 100% Pure Argan Oil. Lisa loved her Super Eye Serum by Verso with Retinol 8 and Pure Iconic Glow Moisturizing Face and Body Dry Oil. Lisa literally relies on FabFitFun and all the marvelous health and beauty products they deliver right to our door. 20 female-founded brands are in the spring box this season. You can choose from a wide variety of products when you order. Receive seasonal must-haves without leaving home. This FabFitFun spring box is still exciting for Lisa to receive, even after receiving FabFitFun boxes for almost 4 years. Lisa tells everyone she encounters about the amazing products and the incredible value. Order your spring box today. Sign up now for the perks of membership, and so you can snag amazing products like the LED Indoor Planner by Short Stories or amazing products like Verso Super Eye Serum when you customize at www.fabfitfun.com. Use coupon code MURDER for $10 off your first box. Order your spring box today. Sign up now so you can snag amazing products like the LED Indoor Planner by Short Stories or Versus Super Eye Serum when you customize at www.fabfitfun.com. Now, Caitlin, we were talking about the Zahaus now and the seven-week investigation by San Diego Sheriff's Department, that somebody was watching that press conference. Somebody, a forensic pathologist, a famed forensic pathologist, Cyril Wecht. Tell us about Cyril Wecht and what the next step for the Zahau family was, considering that the Sheriff's Department still considered this a suicide.
You know, I'm not really sure how he got involved. I don't think he was watching the news conference. I think what happened is Ann Bremner, she's an attorney up in Seattle. She gets involved in these high-profile cases, and she works sometimes pro bono. She helped out the Zahaus. She also helped out Amanda Knox, if you remember that case.
Right.
So I think, you know, I think she's the one who got Cyril Wecht involved, or it's possible that a reporter from one of the news stations called him and asked for his opinion because they didn't televise that news conference, and so because I couldn't watch it, I tried, and you know I couldn't get access to it. They posted it later. They also did not release the autopsy report to the reporters at that. Before that news conference, they had to ask for it, I think, and so I know that once they got that, you know, they didn't get a chance to compare what was in the autopsy report with what the sheriff's detectives said at that news conference. So it looks like it was later that same day that this happened, and it was kind of over, you know, the course of a couple news cycles within a day, but Cyril Wecht somehow weighed in, and he got involved with the Zahaus and Ann Bremner, and they ended up on the Dr. Phil show because they basically, Dr. Phil decided to get involved, and he helped pay for Cyril Wecht's services. They exhumed Rebecca's body, and this was a big deal, too, because you know, there's a house that actually did not want an autopsy in the first place. They wanted, you know, they're a very religious family. And they said, we still have a chance. I think they actually said, we still have a chance to save her. And I think that was what they said, which I thought was an interesting choice of words, but I might be misquoting it. I think that's what they said. But my point was, they wanted her body intact, okay, for reasons, and religious reasons. And they told Jonah that, but it didn't. In the end, the sheriff's department sent the body over to the medical examiner's office. The medical examiner's office never even notified the family officially that Rebecca was dead, which was another thing that made the Zahau family mistrust the authorities and the sheriff's department in particular, even though it wasn't the sheriff's department's duty. The way that they found out that was Rebecca was dead was that Jonah called Rebecca's sister's husband, who was a police officer, because he wanted, you know, he didn't know how to deliver that news and thought it better be coming from a family member. So, you know, that's how that went. And
right.
So, so anyway, this, the house were upset and they were like, no way, this, she never would have done it. So after they officially said, after the sheriff's department officially said that it was a suicide, Ann Bremner got involved. They got Cyril Wecht involved. They got Dr. Phil involved. They exhumed the body. He did a second autopsy. But parts of her body were missing. So he did the best he could, and he used the first autopsy report to, you know, analyze. And what he said initially was that he thought, you know, there were certain things that looked suspicious enough. And he didn't say it was a murder. He said he thought it needed to be, it needed more investigation because he just thought maybe it should be changed to undetermined at least, because he thought it looked more like she had been strangled
mm-hmm.
because of the injuries in her neck. So it's similar to the Jeffrey Epstein case. You know, there are certain
right.
parts of your neck that you see are broken or more severely injured when somebody hangs themselves versus when somebody strangles them, okay? So there are certain, so, you know, in Rebecca's case, if she threw herself over that balcony, which is what they say, you know, Cyril Wecht later was asked to testify for the Zahau family, and they had another expert as well. And by this point, this is years later, 2018, that was 7 years later, he was then saying that she was murdered. But there were, he said there were four subgaleal hemorrhages on her scalp where he
right.
thought it looked like she'd been hit over the head with a blunt instrument. And then, you know, her neck was not broken, and she, falling from 9 feet and 2 inches, he said, you know, why wasn't she decapitated, partially or completely decapitated? And there was another
right.
expert who testified who said the same thing. I mean, that's a long way to fall. Because normally, it's called a long fall. So a short fall for most hangings is like 1 or 2 feet, where somebody will, you know, hang themselves over a doorknob and put the rope over the top of the door and use a sheet or a cord or something, and or, you know,
right.
step off a chair or whatever. So, but that's only 1 to 2 feet, and so you'll see different injuries than if you're going to fall 9 feet. So anyway, Cyril Wecht, when they did the second autopsy, brought these things out, and the sheriff's department just still said, no, we're not changing anything. So Cyril Wecht, you know, he's a renowned guy, gets involved in controversial cases. And by the time he testified in the trial in 2018, I think he was 88 years old, and he was still sharp as a whip.
Yeah. When you talk about the civil lawsuit, there was amendments made along the way. You talk
right.
about the attorney Greer making these amendments. What was the final amendment, and when did this civil lawsuit actually take place?
Okay, so first of all, there were many changes, and this took years, by the way. So, I mean, when people used to ask me about this case, initially I was like, I can't write about this case because the sheriff's department said there wasn't even a crime. How am I going to write a no arrest,
mm-hmm.
let alone conviction, let alone a criminal trial or a criminal case even? The Zahaus were really determined. So they went through a number of attorneys. They tried to get the Attorney General's office to reopen the criminal case. They tried everything. They, you know, they worked with Ann Bremner. Ann Bremner was not in California, so she had to team up with some California attorneys because she wasn't licensed to practice here. So, they went through a series of teams of attorneys to get the case reopened, made a bunch of allegations. Nobody was listening. DA's office didn't listen. Attorney General's office didn't listen. So finally, there was a civil suit filed, but it was filed in federal court at first. And the federal court said, you know, they didn't have jurisdiction. And Initially, the allegations were pretty vague. Initially, it was Dina Shacknai and her sister Nina Romano and Adam Shacknai. All three of them were named as conspiring and scheming to kill Rebecca Zahow, although they still didn't really know how they did it. So eventually the lawsuit was moved into state court, and then it was amended, you know, a good four times, if not more. I can't remember if the four times include this federal initial filings, but there were four or six versions of this lawsuit. And in 2017, Keith Greer, the House attorney, said, he held a news conference and he said, "I apologize. I am dismissing Dina and Nina from this lawsuit because I, you know, it turns out that Dina was at the hospital like she said she was."
Right.
So
yeah.
I guess he had this video surveillance stuff, tape or whatever, but he didn't look at it. I don't know. I don't know if there's a lot of hours, I guess, that were on there, and he didn't sit down and look at it until then. But also, Nina's insurance company settled with the Zahows against her wishes, and so he dismissed both of them. And
right.
So then there was just Adam. So by the time the case finally went to trial, it was just Adam, and it was Adam who killed Rebecca Zahow, strangled her, put her over the balcony. And once we got to trial, he changed it yet again, and now during the trial he said that Adam Shacknai sexually assaulted Rebecca with the wooden handle of a knife that was found on the floor in that guest room next to the bed where the hanging rope was anchored. And he said that that came from one of his experts was looking at the photos, and I don't know if she actually had the knife itself in her hand. I don't think you're allowed to touch evidence like that. But she said she saw some white-ish discharge, and there was red stain on the metal rivets up to the second rivet, and that she thought that that meant that he stuck that handle inside Rebecca's vagina because Rebecca, the only source of blood, there was no wound on the body that was bleeding profusely, but she was having her period. And the curious thing was there were several drops of blood in the hallway as if she were standing there, either, you know, they said, well, that's where she was standing having a confrontation with Adam. And then he grabbed her. She screamed for help. A neighbor heard it because a neighbor reported to the police that she heard somebody, a woman crying for help around 11:30
right.
that night.
Mm-hmm.
And she tried to get away. Adam hit her over the head, tied her up. She tried to free herself by trying to cut the rope with another knife that was on the floor also. And this is the same expert who said, if you look at the pattern of fingerprints on the handle, or no, especially the blade of that knife, facing the other way, away from her, as if she were trying to saw her way out of these ropes. Except she admitted there was no cut marks on the rope itself. So these are just theoretical interpretations of the fingerprint positioning on the blade of the big knife and on the red stain on the rivets of the knife handle. Because the medical examiner said she did not have any signs of being sexually assaulted, but they, you know, the house said, well, this is a steak knife handle. This is like the size of a tampon. You're not going to have trauma from that. It's not the blade itself. It's the handle. So it's not going to cut her. So they basically painted Adam Shacknai as this sexual deviant who was watching her take a shower. And, you know, he admitted to watching porn the next morning. And so Keith Greer basically just said he was a pervert. He, you know, was masturbating the next morning because he was finally, you know, basically pleasuring himself with thinking about what he had done to her.
Wow.
So that was their case against Adam Shacknai. Adam Shacknai said, absolutely not. I never touched her. I did not assault her. I did not hit her. I did not even go into the house. I called 911 because I was, you know, trying to get her help.
What did the prosecution Zahow's attorney use as a prop to dramatically demonstrate some of the injuries to Re- Rebecca at this supposed suicide.
Yeah, so this was quite the spectacle. This was a sex doll, essentially, that Keith Gear had made. I think it cost something like, I don't know, $5,000, something like that. Yeah. Did you say $8,000, right?
Yes.
$8,000. I like it when you remember my book better than me. well, you know, I got a lot crammed in here. Anyway.
Sure.
So, yeah, he basically had it made to look like her. So with the same long black hair, this literally the same painted colors on her fingernails and on her toenails, which were two different colors, by the way. And then there were certain, you know, bruising ligature marks around her neck. And curiously, there were two. So that was another question. Why would she have two deep ligature, you know, bruising, like linear bruising on her neck? Why not just one if she was just hanging there? And there were, you know, other abrasions. And there was, you know, some other stuff that they found on her body. And I didn't look closely at the mannequin just to compare exactly, you know, exactly all of the markings, because the defense was arguing against using this thing at all because they just said it was so prejudicial. And so they fought and they fought. They fought in limine motions, pretrial, which are basically, you know, where they try to prevent certain evidence from being presented.
Sure.
And Keith Greer just kept fighting to use this mannequin. So they would argue about this before the jury was brought in, and he was allowed to use it for his expert who was doing the knot tying, did a demonstration on the mannequin. But the agreement was you have to cover the entire thing with a white sheet, and all that can be exposed is just the limb that he's doing the demonstration on. So the ankles were tied together and the wrists were tied together, so he was only allowed to reveal that portion of the body at one at a time until the closing argument. Again, the defense is fighting against letting him use this. But I walked into court that morning, and Greer calls me into this little side conference room, and I'm like, okay. He goes, what do you think? Should I use it? And I'm like, oh, my God, I can't have this conversation right now. I'm covering this case. Yeah, so I just said, well, it's very dramatic, and that's all I said, which was true. And so he was trying to decide whether it would be good dramatic and work with the jury or bad dramatic and not work with the jury. So he decided to use it. And I have to tell you, he was able to have her up on this. He rigged it up so that she was literally hanging, and he had a blue surgical robe that was around her body, and then he had the white sheet on top of that. He pulls the white sheet off, and then he pulls off the I'm trying to remember. I think he did take the blue surgical robe off as well. But anyway, Jonah was sitting right in front of me, and we had not met each other at that time. But he was literally sitting right in front of me, and I saw him shaking his head. He was just like, I can't believe this is happening, kind of thing. And so we talked about that later. I mean, even I gasped. I was just like, I was pretty horrified because it was so lifelike. You could not imagine that wasn't her. You know,
Wow. You
just couldn't help it. It was very dramatic. And so it worked. You know, the jury did ultimately vote 9-3 that it was a murder. So, you know, Jonah was horrified and upset, basically saying he thought that was so disrespectful to the Zahel family and, you know, to him and to Rebecca. But it worked. You know, it did convey what, you know, what she looked like at that point. And part of the reason he said he made use of that was his argument was that Adam didn't need the table to cut her down, that you know, measuring how far her feet were off the ground and how tall she was, he said, look, I can cut right like this. I didn't need to get up on a table. It was just to document this whole show that Adam wanted to have on tape of, you know, him cutting her down so that it would be all documented, that his story of what how things happened. So Adam says, well, I thought she was too high and I needed a table to cut her down. So that's two different stories, but, you know, it was pretty dramatic.
What did Adam have to say, and what did the media have to say after this civil lawsuit?
Well, the jury came back pretty fast. It was a little over 4 hours, and in a civil case, that often means that the defense won. Just like in a criminal case, it means that the prosecution won. So it's kind of weird, but
right.
That's people were thinking, wow, they came back so fast, they must have cleared Adam, right? But
right.
It turns out that they didn't. So they basically voted 9-3, and that's what they need in civil court. So they don't need they don't need a unanimous vote.
Mm-hmm. From that decision, what does the Zahal family do as a result? What do they want as a result of this civil lawsuit? They certainly not interested in money so much.
Well, that's a matter of some debate. If you ask Jonah
mm-hmm.
and Adam, Adam's literally called the Zahal family grifters, which I thought was very insensitive and not very smart on his part for his own, you know, for appearance's sake, but he doesn't seem to have a filter. So the Zahals, after the verdict, held a news conference outside on the steps, and Mary just said, you know, I'm so relieved. I'm just so relieved that the jury, you know, I'm not crazy. She was murdered. I really believe she was murdered. And but what we really want is for the Sheriff's Department to reopen the criminal case, because we want justice for Rebecca, and we just don't think that the Sheriff's Department did a good enough job, and they, you know, want it reopened. So within a matter of maybe an hour, 2 hours tops, the Sheriff's Department came out right away with a statement saying, now think about this. This is a criminal justice agency that arrests people and puts them on trial, right? I mean, they're not the ones trying them, but they prepare the case for the prosecution and work together to prepare a case to present to a jury. And they want you to respect the jury's verdict. But in this case, they said, we are sticking to our findings. So that did not play well. And Sheriff Gore was in a re-election campaign, and right away his opponent said, well, you know, if I'm elected, I'm going to reopen this criminal case because this just isn't right. You know, there's a jury finding. There's obviously something there. This is just pride, you know. And this is one of his lieutenants, too, by the way, who's running against the sheriff. So under the political pressure of a re-election campaign, the sheriff decides that he's going to do a, quote, review. Now, this is not – he makes it very clear, though, that he is not reopening the criminal case.
Mm-hmm.
He is conducting a review of the original investigation, and a new team of detectives will take a look at whatever theories were presented during the trial. And he says, we'll have that done in 4 months. So this was before the election. But it wasn't. So it was 9 months before they finally came out with their findings. This is after not re-interviewing anybody, not interviewing anybody new, not using new DNA technology to retest certain items that had insufficient amounts at the time to register, you know, as belonging to anybody in particular. There were several items that had mixed profiles, and one of them was not Adam Shacknight. Adam Shacknight was ruled out from all DNA and fingerprints, okay? But there were some items where Adam was excluded, but there was still an unknown profile on there. That wasn't Rebecca's. So, you know, that was a question that people, why didn't you retest that? I asked them that too, and they said, well, we talked to the crime lab and we determined that it wouldn't have made a difference. Didn't play well with some people, though.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so 9 months later they came out again and said, still suicide.
Yeah. So what can the family do? I know that you conducted your own investigation. You spoke to players after this decision in civil court.
Mm-hmm.
And you provide some very, very interesting information in this book, and we won't give that away.
Thank you.
There's so much to talk about in that investigation and all the players that you eventually got to speak to,
mm-hmm.
including Adam himself and Jonah, and again, players like Gore and Greer.
Mm-hmm.
This story, you got involved right from the very beginning, you said, because it resonated with so many people and the story went global. Tell us a little bit about how big a story this is and how engaged people are about this issue even today.
How much time do we have left?
Got a couple minutes.
Okay. Because what we didn't talk about is why it resonated with me, which I'd like
mm-hmm.
to mention.
Yes. Yes.
It really resonated with the public because a lot of people didn't believe that a woman, and Rebecca in particular, would have killed herself or killed herself like this. So I think we've discussed this on your show before. It's not a secret, but my husband, I was not married for that long because my husband had a lot of problems. He was diagnosed after we were married, while we were in marriage counseling, by our marriage counselor, who did not tell my husband, only told me that she had diagnosed him with borderline personality disorder, which is a huge, that was not fun that day. I remember hearing that. People steal, people act out, you know, with addictive behavior, substance abuse, they lie, they have sex with people, they do all kinds of stuff. So now my husband was also an alcoholic, and again, didn't know that before I married him either. And in the end, you know, he also picked up a bat and threatened me with it, and that I called 911, and we were kind of going around the couch. He was trying to get the phone away from me, and I was on the phone with the 911 dispatcher. I had to call 911 from my newsroom when I worked at the paper because he was threatening to kill himself over the phone with a gun, and I had to have the police come to the house, and they chased him, and it was just like, it was a roller coaster marriage. It was hard. But mm-hmm. in the end, he drank again after being in recovery for a year. He relapsed, and I just said, I've got to end this relationship. You drank again, and I said, if you did that again, we're done. And several days later, he hung himself in a motel room in Mexico. And the last time I talked to him, he was calling me. I was worried about him. I mean, I still cared about him. I still worried about him because he had threatened to commit suicide before. And I said to him, do you feel like hurting yourself right now? And he said, not right now. And so that was the last time we talked. And then a few days later, he was found, and he hung himself over a door with a cord. And I guess he also ingested some glass shards, ground up light bulb or something. I mean, pretty desperate guy. And so I know what he was acting like, and I know he had a lot of problems. And so, you know, I was drawn to this case partly because of what happened with my own life, but also because I couldn't help but compare the two situations. And
right.
Initially, you know, her family said she's never been diagnosed with any mental illness. She wasn't depressed. She was a happy person. She was a strong person. she worked out a lot and, you know, she slept, but it was because she worked out so much. When she, you know, she just sleeps sometimes, but that is actually a sign of depression. And mm-hmm. the notes on her phone really did sound pretty distressed, and the sheriff's department used those to, you know, to back up their ruling that it was a suicide. But more than that, the more I got into this case, that over the years, after the trial, after I interviewed her, one of her former boyfriends, Michael Berger, who said that she disappeared one day and didn't show up at work, and she called him up crying and said she'd been taken, they've taken me, and he says, "Where are you?" She says, "I don't know." And she's like, "Well," he goes, "well, look around." She goes, "I can't. They've got something over my eyes." And she's crying. So basically, she's claiming that she's been kidnapped. And he truly believed that she had been kidnapped. I mean, he heard fear in her voice. And I thought to myself, wow, you know, my husband did that same kind of thing to me. He disappeared
right.
one night, and he wasn't where he was supposed to be. I drove around looking for him. He walked in the house, and he claimed that he had been pulled over by the police and, you know, taken to the station and strip searched and a cavity search. And I was like, oh, my God, that's terrible. But he was crying. And, you know, I'm like, I wanted to believe him, but I knew yeah. something weird. So I just started seeing these parallels. And I'm not, just so I am clear, I'm not taking a position in the book. I'm not taking a position now. I am not convinced either way that she committed suicide or that she was murdered. So I have remained objective, which I think is the best thing anyway as an objective journalist doing a book on this case. I did see some parallels in their behavior. They both were arrested for shoplifting in Phoenix and went through the same diversion program. So there's quite some very strange coincidences there. So anyway, that's why I got drawn to the case, but also because it was such a big case here for everybody. I mean, I have never had this much anticipation for one of my books. People were like, "I can't wait for this book. Are you done yet? Are you done yet?"
Yeah.
So people really wanted to read this book more than any other book I've ever written. Honestly, it's been nice.
It is a fascinating mystery here, and some of the information that you just alluded to as well, but some of the behavior that she had exhibited in the past, exaggerating and basically even making up entire stories about abductions and things when in actuality it was just a case of wanting to go back and forth with this ex-husband. So there is a lot more to this story, and you do an incredible job contributing to that mystery, because I say that after reading this, I'm still, just like yourself, definitive conclusion
yeah.
to be made. But I encourage people to...
Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
I just encourage people to pick up Death on Hoshin Boulevard, because this is one compelling, disturbing, and fascinating story and case, I have
Thank
to say.
You. Appreciate that.
For those that might want to find out more about Death on Ocean Boulevard, you have a website people might want to take a look at. Can you tell us about
yes,
that before
I
we let you go?
It's CaitlinRother.com. And because this book was released during the lockdown and written during the lockdown, I've done pretty much every event online. And so I've got a virtual tour calendar that's on my blog. And I've literally posted links for every single podcast and every event, every news story, every TV story, every radio story is pretty much there. So you can watch it from anywhere in the world. Just go down the links, and you can hear all kinds of stuff that we didn't even talk about today, too. So
absolutely.
I encourage people to do that, and I hope people will buy the book and write a review, and I would be ever so grateful.
Yes. Well, it's been fascinating. Thank you so much for coming on and talking about Death on Ocean Boulevard, Inside the Coronado Mansion case. It is truly a fascinating case and so much more to discuss. Thank you so much, Caitlin Rother, for this interview. You have a great evening. Thank you.
Thanks, Dan. You too. Bye-bye.
Good night.